It is Niall Boylan with you for the next hour or so. Let's get straight to it. Helen McEntee says she will not be deterred by protesters or violent protesters at the Coolock site. Now, I've been reading over the last couple of days different opinion pieces on what's going on in Coolock. In case you're unfamiliar with what's going on in Coolock, as you well know, the old Crown Paint Factory has been taken over by the government, and they will be putting in their people who have come to the country seeking international protection. Now, reading from Grip Media, by the way, the government is currently looking at more than 30 large buildings for use as accommodation for migrants and asylum seekers, despite the clashes and the unrest in Coolock this week, as the Gardaí moved to facilitate development of a site for accommodation for hundreds of asylum seekers. They also say in response to Senator Michael McDougall has said he understood that people felt fear and apprehension about the future for the local communities if large numbers of people are accommodated in single centres in certain locations. Also, according to the IPAS statistics, 10,604 persons have applied for asylum here since January 2024. That's an increase of 93.9% on the figure for the same period last year. The highest number of applicants is from places like Nigeria, Jordan, Pakistan, Somalia, Bangladesh. And that was reported up to June the 30th, 2024. Last time I looked, there was no wars or no particular wars in those countries. So most, as predicted, don't qualify. They're economic migrants. Now, according to Ben Scallon from Grip Media, the population of the Republic of Ireland may exceed 7 million by the year 2057 under a high migration scenario examined by the Central Statistics Office. According to the new data released today, the range of the projected Irish population by 2057 varies widely depending on the different migration scenarios. Depending on the amount of net migration per annum, the CSO scenarios see the Republic of Ireland's population reaching 7 million, 6.4 million, or 5.7 million, respectively, by the middle of the century. Now, John McGurk also reported on it this week on the riots in Coolock, saying, "Yesterday, amidst the rioting and the violence, I noted the usual sniffy snark from the well-to-do Middle Ireland. It's well for them. They have the time to be burning out Garda cars on a Monday afternoon when the rest of us are out at work." Because, of course, the perpetrators of yesterday's protest and the day before's protest slash rioting were in a substantial part drawn from the ranks of the unemployed and arguably unemployable, according to John. And the government are suggesting now, of course, the plans to procure more buildings like this will continue. They say they're engaging with locals. Of course, if you believe telling locals it's happening, whether they like it or not, is actually engaging. Well, I assume they're telling the truth. But John McGurk also says the rioting we saw yesterday happened in large part because those who rioted feel as if they've nothing to lose and everything to gain from taking the law into their own hands. Are they wrong, he says. So the question is, are they wrong? The question I'm asking today is nearly 2 years later, after these continuous protests on an ongoing basis, probably more protests than I've seen through my whole lifetime, to be honest with you, in the last 2 years, it's not actually making a blind bit of difference. The government are still motoring on with their plans and they're not really interested in what you have to say about it. Because the question is, really, can the government legitimately continue to do this and cause this unrest? Because that is the root of the problem. I mean, all they do essentially is, and you've seen it over the last 2 days, is they will villainise the protesters because, of course, there are always going to be individuals within a protest who will cause trouble. Joining me, and I want to get your opinion, by the way, it's 085 100 2255. Please text or WhatsApp if you want to come on the air. Just WhatsApp the number 085 100 2255. But joining me is John McGurk from Grip Media. John, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Niall. How are you? Niall, can I just clarify something there? When you read out the bit where I said people were unemployed and unemployable, I'm not saying that that's my opinion. I'm not saying that, in my opinion, they're unemployable. I'm saying that's the narrative.
The narrative, that's of course. No, I'm not suggesting about these people. Yeah, they're kind of looking, well, this is what the government have been doing for 2 days. It's kind of villainising a community. Now, we understand, and by the way, everybody condemns or should condemn violent behaviour, setting fire to buildings or setting fire to mattresses or whatever they're doing. We should all condemn that. But the idea that the government, every time these protests happen, be it in Newtown and Kennedy, wherever it happens to be, they just villainise the protesters. That seems to be the way the government operate.
Yeah, as Ben Scallon, my colleague, pointed out this week, 2 years ago, they had a memo. Now, the memo related to Ukrainian refugees, not asylum seekers, but same difference, really. And the memo to Cabinet said that, look, if you start putting large numbers of people into socially disadvantaged communities in particular, you're going to, and this is what the memo said, it's not me saying it, said you're going to undermine social cohesion and cause unrest. And yet that is precisely what they're doing. I'm struck this week that there are two communities experiencing the same thing, and they're two very different communities. There's the community of Dundrum in County Tipperary, which has a population of about 163 people, which has just been told that will play host to 280 international protection applicants. And then you have the events in Coolock, which we're all familiar with. And it strikes me that those two communities have something in common, which is that in both cases, the sites that are going to accommodate these people are sites of government failure. I mean, in Coolock, we're talking about the former Crown Paints factory, which closed down for the last time in 2016, which used to employ 150 people in the local community and which has never been repurposed to any other source of employment for locals. And now that hope has been taken away from them. And instead they're getting, you know, any number between 500 and 1,000 migrants being moved into their community.
What is the number, John? Because I've heard mixed reports both on UK television and GB News and here in Ireland, anywhere between 500 and 1,500. Do we have, I mean, how many can the building hold? Do we know?
There's no fixed number, but we saw mattresses being moved in. Presumably a large space like that, you could accommodate, you know, a couple of thousand people if you really packed them in. But we don't know. That information hasn't been made available. It could be, but it's in the hundreds, certainly in the hundreds. And there was some talk of up to 1,000. And we know that what the government are planning to do, as you mentioned in your intro, up to 30 what they call large scale facilities for hosting people. Now, there are 26 counties in the state. That's more than one per county. You know, by large scale, I take it we're talking more than 1,000, more than 1,500 people per locale. So these are large scale facilities. And then in addition to that, you also have what's happening in Tipperary, where you have hotels being taken over en masse, and the Dundrum House Hotel is going to be hosting 280.
But John, just sorry, before you go any further, the maths doesn't work out on this, because Michael McDougall pointed out the mathematics on this going back a while ago in the House of the Oireachtas when he talked about how many people can actually be, you know, the applications can they do on a single day versus how many people come into the country every single year. And then, of course, out of those people who get rejected, many will make an appeal, which they're entitled to do. That will then have to be looked at as well and processed too. And he worked out the staff could do so many people and no matter how many staff you bring in, even with the extra staff. So realistically, if we have a predicted, you know, 27,000, which is what is predicted this year, possibly 30,000 next year, I don't know. We don't know what the numbers will be next year. According to the European Union, the numbers are going up. More people are coming into Europe on a regular basis. So if we keep doing that, 30 places won't be enough at 1,000 people in each. Because where are they going to go from those reception centres? Are we suggesting we're going to get a house for them or accommodation for them when we already have an accommodation crisis and 14,000 people on temporary housing list, also another 70 or 80,000 people on a housing list as such? So where are they going to go from there? Because surely at some point we have to say the 80% or so that are not genuine asylum seekers have to be returned or sent back to where they came from. At what point are we going to do that? Because that's where this problem lies. Because we could treat the ones who are genuine, we could treat them so much better, support them so much better, if we didn't have to accommodate the ones who are not genuine.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, that is when are we going to start deporting people is really a question for the government, not for me. But you're on to a point that which I think is a really important one. And I've written about this several times, which is the basic supply and demand situation. I mean, if you are, imagine it in an economic terms, if you are producing something, let's say you're a new phone producer and you start producing 5,000 phones a year, and then you're told that a market is actually going to buy 30,000 a year, you're going to increase your production. And it's the same with immigration. If we send a signal that we can accommodate 30,000 people, then 30,000 people will come to take up those accommodation spaces. And when they've come, we're going to need more space and more space after that. And so the government keeps responding to this increase in demand for accommodation by frantically trying to increase the supply rather than by trying to reduce the demand. And I mean, it would seem to me, and I think it would seem to most people logically who understand mathematics and basic laws of the market, which apparently politicians don't, that what you do in this situation is you disincentivize the demand for housing spaces by making it more difficult for people to come here. Mm. I mean, we've just seen this week in other countries in Europe, I think it was the Finns actually put in a law saying, you know, we can arbitrarily reject asylum seekers. Now, their law was predicated on the idea that these were people coming from Russia as part of what it calls asymmetric warfare, where Putin was sending people across the border to cause difficulties. But the point still stands. they've said in some circumstances, we can just say, no, you're not getting into the country.
We don't have a deterrent. And I talked about during my campaign, of course, for election, I talked about the triple D, which was, you know, the detention, the deterrent and the deportation. But the deterrent is ultimately the most important thing. And we saw that with the Rwanda plan when the Rwanda plan existed, going back a couple of months ago in the United Kingdom, where as soon as the suggestion of you were going to Rwanda or you got a letter saying, listen, you're part of the plan, barristers and solicitors for those people, you were saying, look, your best bet is to go to Ireland. There's nothing we can do this. It's gone through the Supreme Court, etc., etc. Now, that's been scrapped, of course, by Keir Starmer. And that problem is going to get worse because more and more people are now going to start coming into the United Kingdom. So they're going to come here as well. So that we don't have the deterrent. The deterrent is deportation, ultimately, and fast processing. But we don't have that.
No, and it would be very difficult to, I mean, this, the thing about the deportation system is that, I mean, you really need to get on here and interview Niall as a barrister and ask them why the legal system facilitates such endless appeals. Because it's okay for the government to say, you know, we're going to deport you. But I mean, the actual, by the time that person goes through their legal right to appeal and review and judicially review and appeal again, and maybe go to Europe in extreme.
Oh, it's 10 years. Cases. Yeah. And they've already lived a life and their circumstances changed. They've had two kids and all of a sudden then we can't send them home and they'll just put in an application to the Minister for Justice for the right to remain. But OK, getting back to what's happened in Coolock over the last 2 days, we're now into day three. I've no doubt it'll be happening again, sadly, because we don't want to see people in those situations. I mean, there is always going to be an element that caused trouble. And my argument to this, and I was talking on British television yesterday, was that when you've got an area like Coolock, and I was raised in Eadmore, just around the corner, that's where I was born. But when you, you know, I see these areas, the only interaction that most of these kind of 16, 17, 18, 19 year olds have with the police, or the only interaction they've ever had, has been bad. I mean, you don't see very much community policing going on there, you know, going around checking on 12 and 13 year olds, making sure they're not getting into trouble and get being friendly with them. The only interaction is bad interaction. Police are bad. Guards are bad. So, as you rightly said, in their eyes, they've kind of nothing to lose. But do protests in general, when we've seen 18 months of these protests across Ireland, and you know, and they've all kind of ended up the same way more recently, do they serve any purpose then? I mean, does protest work at all now?
Well, protest only works to the extent that it generates political pressure that forces politicians to change their views. That's the point of protest.
That hasn't happened, has it?
And that hasn't happened. And I think in this case is unlikely to happen on the basis that, I mean, the government parties have kind of looked at the election results. They've said, look, we can silo off that anti-immigration vote. Clearly, in an area like Coolock, it's doing more harm to Sinn Féin than it's doing to us. It's not hurting us in our constituencies. Fine Gael got 51% of the vote in Stillorgan, where there's no migrant centre. So on a very purely cynical level, which they would never admit, they don't care about it. But the other point in relation to protests is that, I mean, asylum is the one issue where they have taken it out of the legal system altogether. So I was looking today in The Independent, there's an article today about a woman in Howth who's objecting to the building of, I think, 120 apartments in Howth, saying that the construction of 120 apartments in that lovely part of Dublin would alter the character of the area. And she's taking legal objection and she's submitting her objection to, on board Pinola, and she's slowing the whole thing down. Asylum centres are the only development that can be inserted into your community without any kind of right.
You've no veto over it. No.
You've no veto. You've no... So the government has actually taken away... I mean, I wrote a piece...
But here's the thing, John. They're never going to put an asylum centre in Howth.
Well, they may or may not. It seems to me to be unlikely that they will.
But no.
The point is that in these areas, they've taken people's right to object away. So I wrote that piece yesterday, and the title of it was Why I Won't Condemn the Protesters. Now, that doesn't mean that I endorse the burning of cars or JCBs or the firing of missiles at Gardaí. What I mean is it's pointless. And besides that, it's very hard to condemn people when they've been given literally no other option if they want to put a stop to the facility that they object to. Because any other, I mean, the government for the last 20 years in this country has been trying to build something called the North-South Interconnector, which is a basically a power line that goes from about Meath across the border into Northern Ireland that the government say is vital for our fight against climate change by bringing in power from the north.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to do it because residents who object to that have been able to slow it down, delay it, legally clog it up in the courts. Now, you might say that's madness, but it is the law of the land for literally any other development except for asylum centres which have a planning exemption where the government can simply impose them. And now they all say, oh, we'll consult, but they can literally impose them without consultation. And has any, with this business of the government saying they'll engage in consultations with communities, my question for politicians and journalists would be this: can they cite one single example of where consultations have resulted in one of these centres not going ahead?
I mean, but you had Radhika Gorman yesterday up on his podium telling, you know, people, look, we've engaged. This is a, more or less saying the protesters are not telling the truth. We're telling the truth. We've engaged with the community. Engaging with the community doesn't consist of we're building it, we're putting them in there, and that's the end of it. Because that seems to be what engagement means on their behalf.
Yes. So, I mean, I would love to know from Radhika Gorman, for example, if he says that they've engaged with the community, can he give us four examples of changes that have been made to the operation of this proposed centre on foot of that engagement? Because I guarantee you the answer is no. Engagement from the government tends to mean a lecture. So it means, oh, well, your objections are clearly because you're a racist, so here we're going to bring somebody in to tell you why there is no danger from this and you shouldn't be racist. There, we've engaged, now why are you still protesting? That tends to be what they're talking about here. Whereas actual engagement, if you go through a normal planning process, let's say you succeed, let's say that planning process in Hoth finally goes ahead, and they succeed in being able to build their 120 apartments over that woman's objections. The chances are going to be in that situation that the planner, the people building the thing, will have had to make changes to their plans. They'll have had to maybe put in more gardens. They'll have had to paint it a certain color. They've had to protect local.
Reduce
birds,
the numbers a little bit, maybe. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Reduce the numbers from 120 down to 60, whatever the case may be. And that kind of engagement with the community is kind of compelled by the system. Whereas when it comes to immigration, there's no compulsion to engage with locals at all. So these protests, as I said, are going to keep continuing to get worse. And I think they're going to get more violent. And I think they're going to get more desperate as people, you know, there was somebody who said the other day, I think I heard them in audio in the background of some footage that Fatima Gunning recorded when she was at the protest, somebody saying, look, the only way to stop this place is to burn it to the ground.
And that's not the answer either. Yeah.
One cannot endorse burning things to the ground. But in terms of the legal operation of how this has all been set up by the government, that's also a sort of a factually correct statement. So that is the position in which the government has placed communities, where they feel they have no other option if they want to stop something. They can't go to the courts, they can't go to their local politicians, they can't go to the council to stop the planning of it. So the only objection they feel, and we've seen this in communities across the country, with these arson attacks, which are terrible, but you know, that this is the reason why it's happening, because people have been given no other options. And, you know, that is the position which the government is placing communities in the country and then calling them far right. I wrote a piece a couple of months ago saying it feels like the government is at war with its own people. And I was accused of all sorts of incendiary language by saying that. But if you're on the ground, I mean, I'm not going out burning buildings. I'm not going out attacking Garda cars. But if you put yourself in the position of somebody in Coolock who feels really passionately about this issue, and you ask them, well, what options do they have besides, number one, sit down and take it, or number two, take the law into their own hands? The government is putting them in this position where they no longer feel like they have anything to lose by going down option B, which is taking the law.
Well, it's that old rule, isn't it? When you back a dog into a corner, it'll bite. And unfortunately, that's the situation. Now, getting to the policing that we've seen both in Newtown and Kennedy and now in Coolock over the last 2 days. Drew Harris, of course, has taken no nonsense. He was in Coolock Garda Station for most of the day yesterday and the day before. I've watched some of the videos. And look, yes, you have to fight fire with fire. And yes, there are thugs throwing bottles. Yes, there are people misbehaving themselves. Yes, there are people, you know, setting fire to things. And they have to be dealt with. And they are, what they're doing is illegal. And, you know, you can't just have a free pass for people who break the law. I get that as well. But civil disobedience is a part of protest. But with some of the policing I've seen is reminiscent of Northern Ireland, you know, from the 1970s. I seen one guy standing against a wall. I don't know what he did before the video started. Maybe he did do something. Maybe he threw a missile. I have no idea what he did. But when the four guards ran towards him, he was like about 200 yards away from the protest, and they ran down. He was just standing at the wall. He put his hands up, didn't resist arrest, yet they pulled him to the ground violently, stood on his neck, beat him with a stick, or, you know, one of the nightsticks or whatever it is the riot police have. And then, you know, the riot police officer went off, came back again, start beating him again. The guy wasn't resisting. You know, they had the handcuffs on him at that stage. And I'm going, this is not the style of policing I want to ever see in Ireland. If you go back in time to the May Day riots of whatever it was, 2002, I don't know if you remember those, the May Day riots. You know, the Robocop, remember Robocop? The police were called out for that kind of behaviour. And, you know, that was a huge story at the time. I remember covering it on the radio. The police were called out for, you know, the abusive authority and the over-abusive authority and the way they police that particular situation. We're seeing exactly the same thing now, but it just seems to be acceptable, that type of policing.
Well, it's a class thing, isn't it? And I mean, I think it's very important to say this. I mean, classism is the issue in Irish society that no one discusses. We discuss every other kind of bigotry there is. Racism, anti-traveller, bigotry, sexism. No one ever discusses classism. And so there is a huge difference, I think, between some college student called Finbar getting beaten by the Gardaí and his middle-class parents objecting, and somebody who might have a drug problem. I'm not saying this individual does, by the way, at all, but I'm saying somebody who comes from communities where drug problems are engrossed, speaks with a Dublin, a very thick Dublin working class accent, and protests migrants and might be unemployed. The attitudes in social, in Middle Ireland, which sets opinions in this country towards those two individuals getting beaten up by the Gardaí, are entirely different, because there is classism in Irish society, and there is a sort of perverse joy in seeing the Gurriers getting the crap kicked out of them by the cops. That is just the society that we live in.
But the Garda Síochána must be more professional than that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it's like to be on the front line and be a guard, and I wouldn't do the job for all the money in the world, right? When people are throwing stuff at them or whatever it is, or intimidating them, and you do have to fight fire with fire sometimes, and I get that. But some of the videos I've seen are just outrageous. I don't believe there's a need for that type of policing. I mean, and I put it down to Drew Harris, because obviously he has instructed that is the type of policing that's to be done. And we're seeing that in the protests, you know, and that type of when you have a situation where you have a protest of people who there's a little bit of unrest, and you know, this one single incident will spark the whole thing off, and you've got 30 or 40 guards there. That's fine. They're keeping the peace. They're telling everyone to stay back and, you know, keep the road clear, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 vans arrive, you know, with, you know, the riot squad. I mean, that then becomes more intimidating, and they're standing there with the shields and the batons drawn. You're saying to yourself, this is going to start trouble.
Well, there's two things to it. I mean, first of all, that latter point I think you made is a good one, which is that eventually, as these protests metastasize and grow, the Gardaí are taking the risk that organized groups are going to emerge who feel that they can go toe-to-toe with the riot squad, which would be a disaster for all concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The second point, though, is in relation to what I was saying, I wasn't endorsing the view that the Gardaí should be able to beat people up. I thought the particular footage that you saw, that I also saw, I mean, I'd add a couple of caveats, which is, as you said, we don't know what happened beforehand. We're seeing a particular...
Well, I think it's irrelevant, John, what happened beforehand, because at that particular moment, he wasn't resisting, clearly. So it was, no matter what he did beforehand, he deserves to be charged. Indeed, if he threw a missile or if he was behaving in a violent manner, you know, he deserves to have under the Public Order Act, be arrested, handcuffs and taken away. But I don't believe he deserves what happened.
Yeah, well, I would be advising that individual to strongly consider making a complaint to GSOC, the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission, about that conduct. I think it's certainly worthy of investigation.
I mean, you would also, three councillors there, you'd, I know Malachy Steens was there, Gavin Pepper, and I know these guys have been at all the protests. And I did see a video where they were appealing to the guards that they would try and assist to de-escalate the situation. They were pepper sprayed in the face. You know, and they identified themselves, and I'm pretty sure the guards knew who they were, but they pepper sprayed them in the face. I mean,
yeah, and I think this is part of a concerning pattern, because obviously listeners who may be aware may not be aware that my colleague Fatima Gunning was pepper sprayed by
Newtown Mount Kennedy,
in similar circumstances in Newtown Mount Kennedy,
and she again identified herself as the press.
Identified herself as the press and was pepper sprayed anyway. And I do think there is a pattern here with, you know, there are strong regulations in Garda Síochána around the use of pepper spray. Somebody must be actively disobeying Garda orders. They must be an active threat.
That's not what's happening right now. They're just indiscriminately spraying it. 78-year-old man yesterday and an old woman. You know,
neither you nor I are in a position to be judge, jury and executioner on this, in fairness to the Gardaí involved. But that said, I think there's a case to answer there. I think it's very clear that at least in some circumstances, there are legitimate questions to be asked about whether the Gardaí are exceeding the limits of their operational authority in the deployment of pepper spray and indeed in the violence they're using against protesters. And by the way, this is you and me speaking about it, what we see in sort of reasoned, measured tones. There are a lot of people out there seeing that footage who don't feel any obligation to speak about it in reasoned or measured tones. And the result of that is that you're creating more antagonism between the Garda Síochána and the communities they're supposed to be policing. And the Garda Síochána are being put into this position by a government that is determined to ram hugely unpopular policy down the throats of communities who want nothing to do with it. And then the communities are being blamed for being the ones who are damaging the relationship between between the communities in the state. Mm. This is active government policy. So, I mean, you and I can sit here and talk about it in measured tones all we want, but the people who can put a stop to this are those sitting in government buildings who are making the decisions, who are drawing little circles around maps and saying, we're going to put 1,000 people into this community.
Well, would that be the logical thing to do? Like, because the root of the problem here, you know, was obviously, you know, cut off the snake's tail. But the root of the problem here is that you are the head of the snake. The head of the snake is the decisions, the policy to be made by the government. The root of the problem is you have a government minister who should turn around and say to these communities, not, you know, villainize them. Yes, you can villainize people who cause trouble, and everybody should condemn those who throw missiles or who act the fool or act like thugs, right? Or burn things and all those kind of things, right? But you turn around and you say, right, we're going to pause everything for 3 days. Let's all gather our thoughts. There'll be no more construction. There'll be guaranteed. There'll be no more JCBs, no more beds. 3 or 4 days is not going to matter. We'll sit down, we'll talk to you, we'll ask you what you want, we'll tell you what we want. Can we come to an agreement together? You know, decide on who your spokesperson is or your spokespeople are, if it's to be Malachy Steenson and Gavin Pepper and a few other people who are councillors from Finglas or from the area or whatever, right? Let's all decide, you know, and pick a spokesperson. And we will sit down with the Department of Integration and talk about it. But that's just not happening. It's like we're just ramming it in there. So the government have to take, they're not doing it, but they must take responsibility for creating this division and this problem.
Mm. Well, that's my opinion as well as yours. And I mean, it's very clear to me that the government's approach has been, and you only have to look at the map, to put these centres into areas where they feel that it's not going to particularly damage them electorally as much. I mean, I was struck yesterday that the councillors interviewed representing the area, neither Gavin Pepper nor Malachy Steenson, nor the other councillor involved, the lad from the National Party, whose name I can't remember. None of them represent that area. The councillors who do represent that area are, you know, a former People Before Profit guy who's now independent, a Sinn Féin councillor, and I think another left-winger. So it's a very left-wing area. So the government aren't getting a load of votes out of there anyway. And I really think there's a very cynical approach in government to put these centres into places where it's going to do more damage to the Sinn Féin vote than it is to do with them. I think it's one of the most deeply cynical things any government has ever done, because as people keep making the point, you don't see these centres in Stillorgan, you don't see them in the nice
Falls Bridge or Fox Rock or Dalkey or Killiney or
tend to either go into deprived villages in the Midlands or working class parts.
Well, see, the government's argument on that, John, is, well, it's more expensive to procure a warehouse in the middle of Falls Bridge or, you know, Dalkey or Killiney. But I don't believe that's the real reason. I think we all know that's not the real reason.
That never seems to work the other way, though, does it? To work the other way. They never say, well, it's actually much cheaper to put a new hospital into Coolock.
Yeah.
They never say it's actually much cheaper to invest in services in Drimna.
I think Councillor Glenn Moore, by the way, was the councillor you were talking about.
It wasn't Glenn Moore. It was the lad from the National Party. And again, I genuinely can't remember his name.
Okay.
But Glenn Moore is the Irish Freedom Party guy, but it wasn't him. But okay. So the cost argument only tends to work one way around.
That is okay.
And by the way, that councillor from the National Party, and again, I apologize, I don't want to use the wrong name, it's gone out of my head, but he was speaking and addressing the party. Now, he was making a very political speech.
But he turned his back and he walked, and then they start pushing him with the shields. And he wasn't resisting, he wasn't being violent, he made his point to the guards, quite an impassionate plea, actually, for it all to end. And he turned his back and was walking away peacefully. And they came at him then and started pushing him with the shield. Now, ultimately, the guard fell over, which went down quite well with the crowd in the end. But in saying that, that's not the type of policing I'm used to seeing in Ireland, nor do I want to see it. And I said, it's reminiscent of the May Day riots back in the day when we all condemned that at the time. And I'd like to see Ireland being the kind of country that we can still say, look, we can protest. Yes, there can be a level of civil disobedience that will be dealt with by the guards in a measured manner, but not in the manner that we've seen over the last 2 days,
The other element here, Niall, not to be too self-congratulatory for you and me, but the other element here, which is massive, is the media. Because you and I are discussing this stuff, and it's stuff everyone can see. And we're not minimising. We're not saying, oh, you know, nobody did anything wrong with the protest. Clearly, there were things thrown at Gardaí. There were vehicles set on fire. But we are the only people in the media, it seems to me, you and the outlet I run, who are discussing the other side of this, who are discussing, you know, what clearly seems to us, I think, to be the excessive use of Garda force, which clearly seems to be bad communication on behalf of the state, which clearly seems to be the targeting of working class areas instead of other areas for the imposition of these centres. And yet you've got the Irish Times and you've got the RTÉ and you've got the Irish Independent running stories like how the far right whipped up fear in Coolock, which is a headline in the Irish Times today. So, I mean, some of the propaganda and the propagandizing from people who are supposed to, because they are journalists, hold the government to account is just astonishing. And so many of these people in the media, these weasels, seem to think it's their job to hold the people to account on behalf of the state rather than the other way around. And while that happens, it's very hard to have an open and mature discussion of what's happening in this society, because it pushes people into silos. And it means that people who are perhaps more sympathetic with the protesters feel constantly attacked and are therefore less willing to have a reasonable discussion with the other side. This kind of media bias poisons the entire debate. And it's a huge problem.
Yeah. No, it is a huge problem. But look, we'll continue to fight the fight. The fight for honesty and impartiality when we talk about these things. John McGurk from Grip Media. Listen, thank you very much indeed.